From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
When they were putting in the numbing into my hand, I passed out. And I've never passed out before, so it was quite shocking when I was waking up, and I had no idea where I was, and they hadn't even put the chip in yet, so I had to lie down and kind of, like, regain consciousness and think about where I was and what I was doing. And
spy chips. Major corporations are working right now to install tiny tracking devices on all consumer products. What about in your arm or in your kids? We'll speak with a consumer privacy expert and an embedded journalist, that is, a reporter who embedded a radio frequency identification, RFID, in her arm. But first, an unprecedented settlement. The U.S. government agrees to pay an Egyptian detainee hundreds of thousands of dollars.
A September 11th detainee who was brutally mistreated in the custody of the federal government is compensated for the first time since the September 11th attacks.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Violence continues to rock Iraq. 23 people were killed, 58 wounded in a car bombing today in Baghdad. Over 80 people have died since Tuesday. According to the Washington Post, at least 1,300 people have died in violence since last week's bombing of a holy Shiite shrine in Samarra. In other news, tens of thousands of people gathered in New Delhi today to protest a visit by President Bush to India. A police spokesperson said the crowd exceeded 100,000 people. This is Abdul Hussein, a spokesperson for one of the protests.
Welcoming a person like him is like welcoming a murderer, and he has become a militant and a warmonger. He is a war president. So welcoming a person like him does not make any sense or have any meaning in a country like India. And welcoming him in the country of the Mahatma will desecrate our land.
Dozens of protests have been planned ahead of President Bush's three-day visit. During his stay, Bush is expected to sign a controversial deal to sell India nuclear fuel from the United States. On his way to India, President Bush stopped in Afghanistan for a surprise visit. During his five-hour stopover, the president addressed U.S. troops and met with Afghan President Hamid Karzai. The Associated Press is reporting a helicopter traveling in the president's air convoy to the presidential palace fired at an unspecified target on the ground. It was the president's first visit to Afghanistan. Hours before the president landed, the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency said the growing insurgency in Afghanistan poses a greater threat than at any point since the U.S. invasion in 2001. In testimony before Congress, Lieutenant General Michael Maples said attacks within Afghanistan are up 20% last year. The increase included a fourfold rise in suicide bombings and a doubling of the use of makeshift bombs. Meanwhile, in neighboring Pakistan, the government says it killed three dozen people in an assault on a militant training camp near the Afghan border. In the occupied territories, the top military commander of the Palestinian group Islamic Jihad was killed in an Israeli airstrike earlier today. Khaled Dakhdouh was assassinated as he traveled in his car through a busy street in Gaza City. At least two other people were wounded in the attack. An Islamic Jihad spokesperson vowed revenge. A new poll from Zogby International shows nearly three-quarters of U.S. troops in Iraq believe the U.S. should pull out within a year. One-quarter of those surveyed believe the U.S. should leave now. And only one in five U.S. troops want to heed President Bush's pledge that U.S. forces stay, quote, as long as they're needed. The poll also found an overwhelming majority of U.S. troops believe the widely discredited theory that Saddam Hussein was involved in the 9/11 attacks. 90% said the Iraq war was a retaliation for Saddam Hussein's supposed role in 9/11. Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting an army study has found more than one in three U.S. troops who served in Iraq later sought help for mental health problems. According to the report, soldiers and Marines returning from Iraq reported more distress than those returning from Afghanistan and other countries. More than half all service members returning from Iraq report they had felt, quote, in great danger of being killed there. and over 2,400 reported having suicidal thoughts. Steve Robinson, head of the National Gulf War Resource Center, said, quote, in Vietnam, there were safe areas where people could go and rest and recuperate. That doesn't happen in Iraq. Every place is a war zone, he said. In other news, Knight Ritter is reporting the White House repeatedly ignored early intelligence warnings that the armed insurgency in Iraq was almost entirely local and growing in size. A national intelligence estimate as early as October 2003 said the insurgency is fueled mostly by local conditions such as the presence of U.S. troops in Iraq. It also said outside forces are playing almost no role in the insurgency. Robert Hutchings, the former chair of the National Intelligence Council from 2003 to 2005, said, quote, frankly, senior officials simply weren't ready to pay attention to analysis that didn't conform to their own optimistic scenarios. Another former high-ranking intelligence official said, quote, this was stuff the White House and the Pentagon did not want to hear. They were constantly grumbling that the people who were writing these kind of downbeat assessments needed to get on the team, were not team players, and were sitting up there at CIA headquarters in Langley sucking their thumbs. This news from Japan. A new study has found scores of survivors of the U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945 are still suffering health problems. The Radiation Effects Research Foundation found those survivors who were youngest and most exposed to radiation at the time face the highest risk of illness today. The study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Over 200,000 people were killed in the bombings, August 1945. In Washington, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez left open the possibility Wednesday that the Bush administration's warrantless domestic spy program is more extensive than has been acknowledged. In a letter to senators reported in the Washington Post, Gonzalez attempted to clarify testimony he gave before the Senate Judiciary Committee last month. During that testimony, Gonzalez said the program was all that had been authorized by President Bush. But in Tuesday's letter, Gonzalez wrote, quote, I did not and could not address any other classified intelligence activities. I was confining my remarks to the terrorist surveillance program as described by the president. Bruce Fine, a former government lawyer who served under three presidents, said, quote, it seems to me he's conceding that there are other NSA surveillance programs ongoing that the president hasn't told anyone about. Meanwhile, the USA Patriot Act moved a step closer to reapproval Tuesday. The Senate voted to end debate on proposed changes to the act, setting the stage for a final vote that could come as early as today. Renewal had stalled in Congress amid bipartisan concerns the new measure lacked adequate safeguards for civil liberties. The proposed legislation still includes several provisions that have riled civil liberties groups. Among them, the Renewed Patriot Act would still allow the FBI to obtain internet and email records from library computers. And a coalition representing over 15 million people have started a campaign to oppose internet service provider AOL's plans to implement a so-called email tax. Under AOL's new proposal, mass emailers would be allowed to pay a fee to bypass filters blocking unsolicited email. Smaller groups would have no guarantees their messages would get out to their recipients without paying the fee. This is Tim Carr of the media reform group Free Press.
We have large email providers, including AOL, that want to turn email communications into a privileged realm for those who can afford to pay a corporate tax. AOL's pay-to-send scheme threatens the free and open internet as we know it. It needs to remain a level playing field for all.
That was Tim Carr of Free Press. The website for the campaign is DearEOL.com. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. government has agreed to pay an Egyptian man $300,000 to settle a lawsuit alleging the man was illegally detained during the roundup of hundreds of Arab and Muslim men inside the United States after the September 11th attacks. The man's name is Ihab El-Magrabi. He was detained on September 30th, 2001. Federal agents came to his apartment in Queens, New York, in search of his landlord, who years earlier had applied for pilot training. Even though he wasn't the original target of the investigation, El-Magrabi was detained. He would spend nearly the next year at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn. In the end, He was deported after pleading guilty to the white-collar crime of credit card fraud. But for his year in detention, he was treated like a wanted terrorist. He was kept in a maximum security section of the jail reserved almost exclusively for Muslim or Arab men. Conditions were so bad that the New York Daily News described the site as Brooklyn's Abu Ghraib. According to a lawsuit filed by El-Maghrabi, he was beaten by prison guards, threatened with death, accused of being a terrorist, repeatedly strip-searched, dragged on the ground while chained and shackled, denied basic necessities like a mattress, pillow, and toilet paper. In one instance, he accused a prison guard of making him bleed after a guard inserted a flashlight into his rectum. At other times, they used pencils, he said. El-Maghrabi wasn't alone in claiming abuse inside the MDC, the Metropolitan Detention Center. 2 years ago, the Justice Department's Inspector General, Glenn Fine, issued a damning report implicating 20 guards in carrying out widespread abuse against the jailed men. The report read, quote, "Some officers slammed and bounced detainees against the wall, twisted their arms and hands in painful ways, stepped on their leg restraint chains, and punished them by keeping them restrained for long periods of time." The government actually videotaped much of the abuse, but has so far resisted calls for it to be publicly released. However, the public has seen images from the video showing the prison guards beating detainees. The $300,000 settlement is believed to mark the first time the U.S. government has agreed to pay out money to a Muslim or Arab man jailed in the post-9/11 sweeps. Other lawsuits remain pending in court. We're joined on the telephone right now from his home in Alexandria, Egypt, by Ahab El-Maghrabi. He returned to Egypt in 2003. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Hi, how are you?
It's good to have you with us. We are also joined in studio by two of his attorneys, Hae-Yung Yoon of the Urban Justice Center and Mamoni Bhattacharya of the law firm Weil, Gotshal & Manges. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having us.
Well, why don't we begin with Ahab El-Maghrabi? Your response to the settlement?
Yes.
Your feeling today after the legal case has been settled? Our producer is translating for our guest.
No. I feel, happy because I settled the case and I end up with the case. Because, at least with the money I get, I'm going to cover all the medical problem I have since I returned back from New York. And all these medical problems, I never have it before. I started to have it when I was in MDC in Brooklyn. And at the same time, I'm going to end up with some money, to start my life, because since I returned back from New York, I'm going to be able to work.
What ails you now? How are you feeling?
Since I've been MDC in Brooklyn, I start with some problem in my throat, and they give me wrong medicine, and I end up with very bad hypothyroid.
I described somewhat what you have testified to in your case, but can you tell us exactly what happened to you after September 11th?
Nothing. I have a normal life. I have my restaurant in Manhattan, and I work in the flea market also on the weekend. And I have a normal life. I don't have no problem at all. And in September 30, I returned back from the flea market on Sunday. I found 4 FBI and 2 Secret Service in my house. And they were talking to me like they suspected me because I'm Arab Muslim, I have something to do with September 11. And especially they found the husband of the landlord downstairs. He was applied for to learn how to be a pilot like 5-6 years ago in one school, in some city, I don't know exactly. So they think, I have something to do with the husband of the landlord. So they pick me up from my house and take me to the MDC in Brooklyn.
And what happened to you there?
From the minute, they take me there, they put me in the 9th floor in the special house unit. It's like a room 2x2, and I found all kind of the bad trees, I've never seen this one in my life, You know, I stay like 13 years in New York, like I'm dreaming, you know, I mean, like, I'm in the sky, you know, and from the minute I put my leg in MDC in Brooklyn, I found myself in a different situation at all, you know, I've never had this situation in my life.
What happened exactly?
Like, nobody talk, you know, if somebody want to talk, they talk by hand, you know, not talk by mouse.
What do you mean?
Like, everybody, you know, they kick down, you know, the bush in the back, the bush in the face, you know, the chin all over the body, you know, if you want to move like 1 foot, they put a chin all over in the body.
They put chains?
Yes.
They told you you couldn't speak?
No. You can't open your mouth. If you open your mouth, the bush is against the wall. And I'm allowed only to make one phone call 15 minutes a month. I'm not allowed nobody to visit me. My father, he tried to visit me, and he come special from Egypt all the way to New York to visit me. And they threw him out from MDC. And the manager of the 9th floor with a special house unit, he was tell him, you know, if I see you one more time in the MDC in Brooklyn, I'm going to put you in the cell next to him. And he have to return back to Egypt after 1 week.
Did you have access to an attorney?
Yes. And the only one he can visit me is my attorney.
And then what happened in terms of...
They say, you know, they say like they play game. They say we can remove you from the special house unit until we receive clear from the FBI. You know, have something to do with 9/11. And they receive, you know, some clearance from the FBI, and they still, you know, play game. They don't want to move me from the special house unit to the population. And they keep, like, you know, play game with me like this until I end up with 11 months in the special house unit.
Were you sexually abused?
In my mouth, you know, my teeth, and in my back, you know. And all this problem, I still have it until now. And, you know, I have to do, like, a strip search, and, you know, I can't explain to you, you know, what happened with the strip search, you know, between, like, four officers and one lieutenant. And everybody make fun, and, you know, they take me, like, outside from the cell, and they put me back in the cell. And if I'm going any place, I'm going to court, I'm going any place, I have to do, like, 2-3 strip search when I'm going, and the same thing when I'm coming, I'm back.
How did you finally get out?
I get out, you know, my lawyer, she explained to me, she said, whatever the case is going to give you, you have to plead guilty. Other way, you're never going to come out. She told me, forget about, you know, you come out without case. They have to give you case. So I end up, you know, plead guilty. And I come out from the show. I end up with coming out from the show. And I agree, you know, like, to come back to Egypt.
And you pled guilty to?
To fraud credit card.
Credit card fraud.
Yeah.
And they released you.
Yeah. And they're asking me if I want to return it back to Egypt or I want to stay in the United States. I say, no, I want to return it back. Even I bought my own ticket, and they say, no, we're not going to use it. We're going to use our ticket.
We're talking to Ehab El-Megrabi, who was held in detention in New York for almost a year. His lawyers are also with us. His lawyers joining us in our studio here in New York. Hey, Yung Yun, you're with the Urban Justice Center. How did you get involved with this case?
So I work for the community development project of the Urban Justice Center, which we are a nonprofit legal organization that provides free legal services to community-based groups in New York City. And in the aftermath of September 11th, we were contacted by a community-based group called Islamic Circle of North America, which was providing immediate advocacy to both the detainees and their family members. And we were contacted and learned about the abuse. So that's how we got involved in this case.
How typical is Mr. El-Megrabi's story?
Mr. El-Megrabi is unfortunately too typical. I think that our case, along with the other detainees, have clearly stated that the treatment that he received was very, very common. It was systematic. It was on a daily basis. The physical, the verbal abuse he was subjected to, the brutal mistreatment, the repetitive strip searches, denial of access to calling their lawyers was it occurred on a daily basis, and the fact that this type of treatment occurred in a systematic way because of the fact of there were Arab Muslim men in the wake of September 11th.
This is an unprecedented case. Mamonid Bhattacharya, can you talk about how your own law firm got involved with this case?
Yes. We were contacted while Gotchal and Manjis by the Urban Justice Center last fall, and we have a longstanding commitment. We're an international law firm. We have offices around the world. We're based in New York, and we have a longstanding institutional commitment to pro bono work and service to the community. So when we were contacted by the Urban Justice Center and told about this case, we became very interested. We considered it to be an important case with wide-ranging ramifications, and we were happy to become involved in the effort.
How unusual is this, this settlement that has been arrived at?
It's the first settlement on record that the U.S. government has ever entered into taking accountability for the abuses and the mistreatment of people held in detention in the aftermath of 9/11 around the world, from Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, to right here in Brooklyn.
Do you see other cases following?
We have another plaintiff in this case who continues to fight on in his battle, and there's also a co-pending class action litigation brought by several other detainees who were held in Brooklyn.
And can you talk about the other plaintiff?
Mr. Javed Iqbal is the other plaintiff. He's a Pakistani immigrant. He, too, was rounded up in the sweep after 9/11 and held in the MDC. Again, white-collar crime, charges of white-collar crime were the basis for his initial arrest, having a false ID. However, he was held for months in isolation, abused physically, verbally, severely beaten, isolated from legal counsel, from any contact with the outside world, with no end in sight. And he was ultimately cleared of all links to terrorist charges. There was never any credible link to any kind of terrorist activity. And when he was ultimately cleared, he was finally deported, but not after, only after being held for months and months and abused and mistreated.
And how far along is his case?
He was recently brought back to the U.S. and deposed in early February. And after that, the case is proceeding.
We're going to break and then come back to this discussion. After that, we talk with a consumer privacy expert on spy chips, RFID, radio frequency identification chips that some are having implanted in their bodies. But we are talking right now with He Yung Yoon, attorney with Urban Justice Center, Mamoni Bhattacharya, who is with Wael Gotchal and Manjis, and the man himself who spent almost a year in prison, in detention in New York, Ihab El-Maghrabi. We'll be back with them in a minute.
Square. It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly real. Disorder from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
It's coming from the silence. democracy. Leonard Cohen here on democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 400 stations around the country on Pacifica, NPR, Low Power FM, and community and college radio stations, as well as on public access and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. At our website, you can also see transcripts of our broadcasts each day. I'm Amy Goodman, and our guests are Hae-Yung Yoon, who is an attorney with the Urban Justice Center, Momone Bhattacharya, who is an attorney with a law firm in New York, while and Manjis. And in the on the telephone with us from Alexandria, Egypt, is Ihab El-Maghrabi, who has an Egyptian citizen detained in New York after September 11th, spent nearly a year in jail, has gotten out, and is now the U.S. government has agreed to pay $300,000 in an unprecedented settlement. Ihab, when you were here in New York at the MDC, did you think you would ever get out?
No. I was thinking this is the end of my life, you know. I was thinking the way they treat me, you know, I think, you know, like I did something wrong in my life and this is the end of my life. I'm never going to see my family again. I'm never going to see the street again.
What gave you hope to make it through?
From all the bad things I see around me, you know. And it's not only with me, you know, with some other people also, you know. I see how is the way they treat me, you know, how is the way, you know. I've never talked to people like this. I've never dealing with people like this, you know. I've been 13 years in New York. And I was seeing, you know, watching TV and I saw all the life, you know. And I saw the newspaper. I've never seen this one in my life. I was thinking like I'm watching a movie, you know. Like I'm having a bad dream, you know.
Before you were detained, you'd run a restaurant, and you also had a stall at a flea market?
Yes.
Do you ever plan to come back to the United States?
I wish I could return back. I don't think I'm not allowed to come back, but, you know, I wish I could return back because I love New York, you know.
The other men who were detained with you, was the same thing happening to them?
I'm sorry?
The other men
yeah.
who you were detained with, was the same kind of abuse happening to them? Were they being abused in prison? The other prisoners?
Okay.
Were the other prisoners also being hurt by the guards?
Yes. Most of the people, you know, like you can say 99%.
Have you told people in Alexandria what happened to you?
Nothing. Since I returned back to Alexandria, you know, I've been until like, been watching from some doctor, you know, and they've been taking some.
What is the, do you, is there any lasting effect of the abuse on you?
Yes, the problem I have in my chest from the hypothyroid and all this medicine I've been taking, I'm not able to work, you know. I have to be, you know, until some medicine, you know. I've been taking some medicine like 3-4 times a day, you know. I'm not be able to work. And plus I have to pay for all the medical, you know, I don't have no insurance in Egypt. Because I lost all my benefit, you know, when I work in New York all this time.
Hae-Yung Yoon, why did you settle?
This was a really hard choice for Ihab El-Maghrabi. It's clear that he you know, started this case wanting to seeking justice for how he was treated, he, I think, understands that he was mistreated because of who he is, his race, and his religion. But it was a hard choice because, as Ihab alluded to earlier in his interview, that he continues to have health problems as a result of the injuries he suffered while he was at Metropolitan Detention Center. So he has hyperthyroid condition, but it was misdiagnosed as asthma without being given any kind of medical examination, and he was treated as if he had asthma, and I think that aggravated his hyperthyroid condition. And he only found out about this when he was transferred to another corrections facility before he was deported back to Egypt. So as a result of that, when he returned to Egypt, he was not able to find employment because he had to deal with his medical issues. And he was facing a very, very difficult choice where although he wanted to continue, he needed to deal with taking care of his health.
Did you want to take this to trial, Ihab al-Maghrabi?
No, for now, no. I don't want to do anything, you know. I just say, you know, I want to finish the case like this, and, you know, if my lawyer, she ends up the case and she's happy with a case like this, I'm happy also, you know, because at least, you know, with the money I get, I'm going to cover, you know, all the loan I'm taking from some people from my family, and I have a big loan I'm taking from the bank I have to pay back, and I'm going for surgery by the end of March. Well, so I have to cover all this, you know.
Your final words as we end this discussion, Mr. al-Maghrabi.
Nothing. I wish this one is not happen again, you know. Because, you know, when the people live in the United States, they love New York, they love any city, when, you know, wherever they live. So, you know, I don't want few people like the people who work in MDC. They make, you know, the idea in my mind or somebody else's mind, you know, they're very bad about, you know, this country or this city. And they say, no, they're very bad people. Because, you know, I've been dealing with some other people for 13 years. And I've never have no problem with nobody.
Well, Ihab al-Maghrabi, I want to thank you for being with us from Alexandria, Egypt, and also your attorneys, Mamonia Bhattacharya and Heyung Yoon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you, Amy.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we move on now to our second segment of the day. Imagine a world of no more privacy, where your every purchase is monitored and recorded in a database, your every belonging is numbered, where someone many states away or perhaps in another country has a record of everything you've ever bought or of everything you've ever owned, of every item of clothing in your closet, every pair of shoes. What's more, these items can even be tracked remotely. Once your every possession is recorded in a database and can be tracked, you can also be tracked and monitored remotely through the things you wear, carry, and interact with every day. Well, we may be standing on the brink of that world if global corporations and government agencies have their way. It's the world that Walmart, Target, Gillette, Procter & Gamble, Kraft, IBM, and even the U.S. Postal Service might usher in within the next 10 years. It's the world of radio frequency identification. That's RFID for short, a technology that uses tiny computer chips, some smaller than a grain of sand, to track items at a distance. If the master planners have their way, every object from shoes to cars will carry one of these tiny computer chips that can be used to spy on you without your knowledge or consent. Those are the opening words of the book, Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and Government Plan to Track Your Every Move with RFID. And today we're joined by one of the co-authors of Spy Chips, Liz McIntyre. She's a consumer privacy expert and serves as the communications director for Caspian. That's Consumers Against Supermarket Privacy Invasion and Numbering, which is a grassroots group that's been tackling consumer privacy issues for many years. She also writes about consumer issues at Money Mom, a syndicated family money writer and columnist. She joins us from Austin, Texas. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy. How are you?
It's good to have you with us. Well,
thank you.
Why don't you tell us about what spy chips are?
Well, as you said, radio frequency identification, or RFID, and they're very tiny computer chips. Some of these are smaller than a grain of sand, and they're connected to miniature antennas. The combination is called an RFID tag. Now, each of these chips has a unique identification number. It's sort of like a social security number for things in that the plan is that no other item would have a chip with the same number on it. And big companies you named, like Procter & Gamble and Walmart, want one of these tags on every manufactured product on planet Earth. And, of course, there's a company called Verichip that would like one of these RFID devices in everyone's flesh.
Now, who is pushing this?
Well, right now, the 800-pound gorilla of RFID in retail is Walmart. Procter & Gamble is another big player. Basically, any major company you can think of is very interested in the technology. Of course, also our own government is starting to put RFID tags in U.S. passports this year. And we're concerned that they may also try to use this in other ways. Already they're experimenting with the technology with the U.S. visit program attaching RFID tags to visitor documents. And, of course, recently we revealed that we found an RFI, a request for information, that shows the Department of Homeland Security is looking for beefed-up RFID that can be read from up to 25 feet away, that can be read in cars speeding by. So potentially a visitor who has an RFID tag on a document could be scanned without his knowledge or consent as he drives by. And, of course, you know, RFID works with electromagnetic radio waves, sort of like the radio waves you listen to your favorite, you know, FM program on, your radio program. And they travel in space through solid objects like purses, backpacks, wallets. And these tags, while they're passive, there's no battery. Anytime they're within range of a reader device, this unique number can be scanned, and you would never know it.
We're also joined on the telephone by freelance journalist Annalee Newitz. She writes about the intersection of technology, science, and culture, a contributing editor at Wired magazine. She's redefining embedded journalist. She just had an RFID embedded in her arm. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi.
It's good to have you with us. Can you explain what you did?
Sure. So I had been researching an article for Wired about security issues in RFIDs, and I read some publicity materials from Verichip in which the company claimed that its chip was couldn't be counterfeited, and so it was the perfect anti-theft key because, you know, the implication was that no one could steal your keys without actually cutting off your arm, although they didn't actually say that in the advertising materials. And so that sounded very curious to me because I hadn't heard of any RFIDs that were completely secure like that, so I decided to find out if it was true. So a very nice doctor at UCLA agreed to implant me with one of them, and very quick operation. And then I visited with an RFID expert named Jonathan Westhues, who has a little iPod-sized device that he made himself. It's a quite cheap homemade thing, and it's designed to clone RFID chips, which means make a duplicate copy of them, basically. And in about 10 minutes, we sat down in a restaurant in a crowded place, and he was able to duplicate the signal from my RFID, which meant that if my RFID had been used to open vaults or locks, he would have been able to duplicate that signal simply by basically bumping into me with his device and then going ahead and using what he'd picked up from it to open up a door.
Can you back up a minute, Annalee? Describe
sure.
The operation.
The getting the implant, you mean?
Yes.
The RFID is it's quite small. It's just a microchip attached to a very tiny antenna, and it's embedded in doped glass. It's a surgical glass that's safe. It's just like the tags that you put into your pet or into your cow if you're a farmer. They take a needle, a hollow needle, and basically just shoot the chip under your skin.
Do you still have this implant?
I do, yes. Unfortunately, as it turns out, they're somewhat difficult to remove because they're so small that although it's easy to put them in, the surgeon explained to me that you kind of have to dig around a little bit to find it, to remove it. So far, I have kept it in.
Do you set off any alarms with it?
No, you don't. Actually, the read range on these, the range that you need to be, you need to be quite close to them to read them. So you really have to be within a couple of centimeters, so it isn't going to set off anything particularly.
Liz McIntyre, have you found that people who have these chips embedded in them might set off something, either at an airport or at a drugstore or a metal detector?
I haven't heard any reports of that, no. In fact, there are very few people who have even gotten one of these things, been crazy enough to do it. So, you know, we really don't have a lot of feedback on what the ultimate effects of this are going to be.
I understand that in New Orleans they're putting these in corpses. Is that true?
Yeah, after Hurricane Katrina, the coroner's office met with Verichip, and of course Verichip was very interested in promoting their technology, and they thought this was a great opportunity. It was like the vultures circling after the tragedy, and they swooped in with their Verichip equipment and had the coroners implant these chips into the remains of the victims and also into the remains of some of the deceased that had been washed up from their graves.
I wanted to read to you from a piece in The Guardian. The headline is, "Girl to get tracker implant to ease parents' fears." It says the parents of an 11-year-old girl are to take the extraordinary step of having her fitted with a microchip so that her movements can be traced if she's abducted. Danielle Duval will have the device implanted in her arm in the next few months. The scientist assisting the plan claimed the miniature chip will apparently send a signal via a mobile phone network to a computer, which will be able to pinpoint her location on an electronic map. That was a piece written a few years ago. Liz McIntyre, is this a trend?
Actually, I spoke with the Verichip people about this, and they actually are talking about at some point having people report back to some home station through the Verichip and some kind of a telephone system. They're very excited about the idea of parolees perhaps reporting to parole officers remotely through a combination of an implanted chip and a telephone of some kind. So, yes, I understand that that is possible. I wonder how that little girl feels, being uniquely numbered and tracked.
The Food and Drug Administration has approved putting these chips in children?
Well, they approved the chip as a medical device. Now, you should understand that does not mean they did extensive testing on it. They simply made some recommendations about what kinds of things companies with these microchip implants should do to make sure they're somewhat safe. We've yet to see some evidence from the Verichip Corporation on things like tests run on people who have gone through MRIs. In fact, their literature that they hand to patients, the fine print on the back, they make them basically sign away their lives, saying that the Verichip may not be merchantable or fit for the purpose, saying that the database linking their information may not be available at some point, the chip may not be readable at some point in areas where there are ambient radio waves. So, the device right now, it's pretty much, as Annalise said, pretty much worthless as a security device. It has questionable value as a medical device when linked to medical records. And as a security, you know, a tracking kind of a thing, it's just, I just don't understand why anybody would want such a faulty, invasive process, procedure.
We have to break. When we come back, I want to ask you about chipping as a way for advertisers to target their consumers better. We're talking to Liz McIntyre, consumer privacy expert. She's co-author of Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and Government Plan to Track Your Every Move with RFID. Also, Annalie Newitz, who writes for Wired and had a chip implanted in her. Stay with us.
I've got you under my skin. I've got you deep in the heart of me, so deep in my heart that you're really a part of me. I've got you under my skin. I tried so not to give in. I said to myself, this affair never will go so well. But why should I try to resist when, baby, I know so well I've got you under my skin. I'd sacrifice anything come what might for the sake of having you near, in spite of a warning voice that comes in the night and repeats, repeats in my ear. Don't you know, little fool, you never can win. Use your mentality, wake up to reality. But each time that I do, just the thought of you makes me stop before I begin.
I've got you under my skin. Frank Sinatra here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk with Liz McIntyre, co-author of Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and Government Plan to Track Your Every Move with RFID, with radio frequency identification. Let's turn to a clip of a young woman who is at a technology fair talking about the implanting of this chip.
They were putting in the numbing into my hand. I passed out. And I've never passed out before, so it was quite shocking when I was waking up, and I had no idea where I was, and they hadn't even put the chip in yet, so I had to lie down and kind of, like, regain consciousness and think about where I was and what I was doing and all that. And then
that is one person's experience, getting this chip put into their hand. Liz McIntyre, how well-known is this becoming? Are doctors actually doing this?
Yes, there are some doctors. In fact, at the VeriChip website, you can find them there in several states across the country. It's being sold to them as a way to increase their revenue for their practices, of all things. It's being pushed a lot to doctors that deal with geriatric patients because they feel like there'll be a big market there. We're seeing more on the VeriChip front, although only about 70 people so far, you know, have been implanted. And, of course, what you were just talking about are people who we call do-it-yourself implanters, people who are putting little chips between the webbing, in the webbing between their thumbs and their pointer fingers. And this is being done by people, and not very many, just kind of 20 and 30 tech types who want a cutting-edge way to, say, open their front doors, access their computer systems, that kind of thing. And many of these chips that they're using are hobbyists' chips you can buy for under $3. They may not even be sterilized. And our concern here is they're setting an example for young people, sort of breaking down the mental barrier to getting uniquely numbered, and, of course, the precursor to being monitored and tracked in society. And the other thing is that, you know, they're getting them to stick these devices in themselves like piercings almost. And I can see where some high school kids might think this is really cool and not consider they could do some serious damage to their hands. There could be infection that could result from it. And just the fact that making a part of your body a key to any kind of a valuable asset could be asking for some serious trouble.
You have a chapter in your book, Liz McIntyre, called Adapt or Die, How RFID, Radio Frequency Identification, backers hope to get you on board. What do you mean, adapt or die?
Well, it was actually the title of a book that was given out at a conference held where heads of major companies were invited back a couple of years ago. I mean, it sounds shocking, but true. And that's really the attitude they have. Companies like Walmart are telling their suppliers, you know, either get on board or, you know, we're just not going to deal with you anymore. Right now, they're forcing their top suppliers to tag at the pallet and case level. But, of course, their ultimate goal is to tag and track every manufactured product, at some point even packs of gum.
How would advertisers track their products if the chip isn't embedded in the individual but in the product?
Well, by association, things you wear and carry could reveal who you are. And this is really illustrated by an IBM patent application we illustrate in our book, Spy Chips. It's a patent application called Identification and Tracking of Persons Using RFID Tagged Items. Subtle, huh, Amy? And in there, they talk about the day when every product will have an RFID tag, and then when people pay for the items at checkout, the unique number on that chip would be linked to that person. You know, if they pay by something other than anonymous cash, by some credit card or check card. And then later when those tags are seen in the environment by reader devices, the number can be gleaned and the exact identity of the person or something about the person can be known. And they talk about, for example, if you have a baby bottle in your purse that's identified, they might flash you an ad for diapers. Which, you know, it would steam most customers to know that someone has plans to spam them with additional advertising. But then IBM goes on to talk about how the government could use this technology and track people in public places with a device they call the Person Tracking Unit. They actually call it that. And they talk about the places to watch people. They say airports, train stations, bus stations, museums, sports arenas, libraries, elevators, and even restrooms.
We're talking to Liz McIntyre. She is the co-author of Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and Government Plan to Track Your Every Move with RFID. You talk trash, how these tags that you throw away say as much as the ones you keep.
Right, right. Well, of course, the line that the retailers and manufacturers are giving consumers is, well, you don't need to worry about this. You know, just throw them away when you get home. But, of course, there are plans for our trash in the RFID world, too. Nothing, in fact, will escape the gaze of the RFID world. If master planners like Walmart, Procter & Gamble, and so on have their way, we have found a patent application by Bell South, in fact, a couple of them, and they're the ones who own Singular Wireless, of course, talking about the day when everything has an RFID tag and, you know, there's a log of everything from the time it's manufactured to the time it's thrown away. In fact, at the dump, they want to have large conveyor devices look through every piece of trash with picker arms, siphon the tag numbers from the items that have been thrown away, and update a database to give a complete history of an item. And, of course, they talk about selling this information to marketers who could then know how long, say, something is kept in someone's pantry, perhaps where items are transported. So, yeah, even your trash will talk if we don't stop it.
How does the government use radio frequency ID, RFIDs?
Well, of course, already they're starting to put them in our passports. And they're using them, of course, in the U.S. Visit program. We mentioned that earlier. And they're looking for, of course, super beefed up RFID now with super capabilities. And in this RFI I mentioned earlier, they're talking about, you know, this super technology, not just for the Department of Homeland Security, but they're talking about other federal agencies. And we are very concerned because of the Real ID Act passed last spring that they will consider putting RFID tags in our driver's licenses. As you know, that act gave the Department of Homeland Security the right to set federal driver's license standards so that every state would have to have certain information in driver's licenses they issue. Now, people are calling that already a de facto national ID because you cannot function in modern society without a driver's license. I mean, you can't even get on an airplane. So imagine if they put RFID tags in these and it becomes a remotely readable national ID that someone from Homeland Security or another federal agency could simply scan as you drive by at 55 miles an hour or as you walk down the street.
Liz McIntyre, you talk about a nightmare scenario and you ask, what if Hitler had RFID?
Right.
Explain.
Well, we believe that if Hitler had RFID, he would certainly have used it to his advantage. He would have probably tagged all of the Jews and tagged all of their possessions. It's interesting that Hitler actually reached out to the cutting-edge technology of the time, which was the punch card system. They hired IBM, the people we just talked about, who have this patent application for identification and tracking of persons using RFID-tagged items. They reached out to IBM, and IBM leased Hitler this technology that allowed him to track every Jew and every possession. And you can bet if he had access to this patent application and this ability, he would use it.
You're saying pull the plug. What kind of movement is developing right now in response to these chips, whether implanted in human beings or in products?
Well, people are very upset about it when they learn about it. Of course, the major companies have been trying to keep this under wraps. Their plan was to kind of slip it in and tell people, oh, it's just an improved barcode, to limit any kind of alarm. Their own studies showed that two-thirds of people they surveyed were very upset with RFID on privacy grounds once they understood what it was and what was coming. So when we say pull the plug, we say that people need to be educated about what's coming. And our book, of course, hopefully will go a long way to that. We also have a website at spychips.com, that's with an S on the end, spychips.com. We have a free newsletter and pictures of some of these devices we're talking about today and up-to-date information. But in addition to educating people ourselves, we need the grassroots people out there to tell their neighbors, their friends, you know, tell them what's coming. Of course, read our book, pass along our website information. And then we need to also shop responsibly. We believe the free market can do a great deal. In fact, we're relying on the free market to help control this kind of invasive technology. Stop shopping at Walmart. I mean, there are plenty of other reasons, too, to stop shopping at Walmart. You know, and tell them why. Say, you know, if you're acting irresponsibly, then we're not going to send our dollars your way. Vote with your pocketbook. Don't buy things from Procter & Gamble, the company that is really promoting this technology. I mean, they're the makers of many major products. We're talking Tide laundry detergent, Cascade dishwashing detergent, Pantene shampoo. Gillette is another big offender, you know, with their Mach 3 razor blades. They ran a trial that was, you know, very invasive in England not too long ago. You know,
what do you mean very invasive?
Well, you know, there have been several already, although RFID isn't everywhere yet. There have been several cases in which it's been used to spy on people. In a store called Tesco in the UK, sort of like our Walmart, Gillette rigged what they called a smart shelf in that store. And each of the packages of Mach 3 razor blades on a shelf had an RFID tag in it. The shelf had the technology, the reader device, to know when someone picked up one of the packages. When that happened, a camera took a close-up mugshot of the shopper without his knowledge or consent. And then later at checkout, another close-up mugshot was taken. At the end of the day, the picture at the shelf and at checkout were compared. And if there weren't matching photos, then they assumed the person was a shoplifter. And they would follow that person closely the next time. And now, never mind that the person had, you know, their mother-in-law pay for the blades or they abandoned them in the magazine rack. That's what happened. And of course, the Guardian newspaper helped us break that story. And people were all up in arms, and that shelf disappeared pretty quickly.
And pharmacies, how would they be using RFIDs?
Well, pharmacies. The FDA is very interested in this technology. They want to track drugs from the time they're manufactured all the way to the time they're sold to consumers. And our position is, you know, use the technology in your warehouses. We're not going to fight that. We'll let the labor unions worry about all those electromagnetic radio waves that could cause, you know, health issues. That's another matter. But we say, you know, once that prescription is dispensed to a consumer, that there should be no tag on that container. A consumer should not have to worry about his medical privacy, wonder if someone is scanning his pharmacy bag or scanning his wallet or wherever else he's carrying a prescription to get information about what he might be taking or even use that number to track him. And in fact, we just issued a joint statement with EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center. And we sent that to the FDA the other day when they requested comments, and we're both of us are joining and saying no to RFID tags on the packages consumers take home from pharmacies.
Well, Liz McIntyre, I want to thank you very much for being with us, consumer privacy expert who, together with Catherine Albrecht, has written the book Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and Government Plan to Track Your Every Move with RFID. That does it for today's broadcast. I look forward to seeing folks tonight in Santa Fe at the Lensic Theater. Tomorrow we'll be broadcasting from Albuquerque, next week from London. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabdo Kadoos, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Maddie Harbour, Aaron Mate, Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.